history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some pretty incredible stories out there waiting to be told if we'll take a little time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We definitely want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in Nampa, Idaho, to meet George Eldridge, and I'm told he's 100 years old, but he sure doesn't look like it. What's your secret, George? A centenarian, and you stand straighter than I do.
It's real simple.
All right.
Just pick your parents, and then get an electric toothbrush.
Great advice. I'm sure everybody is lining up to go pick one of those up right now.
Just stay healthy.
Staying healthy, and clearly you've done that. We're going to hear about your 28 years in the Air Force, including time in B-26s in Europe during World War II. But take me back to your childhood in Kansas, Alma, Kansas, between Manhattan and Topeka. How big of a place is that?
About 1,000. County seat, very rural area, mostly pasture, white-faced cattle.
So you're growing up there, the oldest of five kids. What was that childhood like in the 20s and 30s?
It was hard work, walked to school. I did everything on a farm or ranch.
How demanding was that? Do you remember a particular task that you had to carry out on the farm that was the toughest? Milking cows or what?
Milking cows, building fences, mowing hay, stacking hay. Back in the days when they used an old hay stacker.
I know this a long time ago. But do you remember having a dream, an ambition? Maybe it was just to get off the farm, I don't know. But did you have a dream of, hey, when I grow up, I want to do X, Y, Z?
It probably changed during my childhood considerably. I was good at math. I studied accounting, but I got diverted by the occasions of the day. I took some opportunities that I was always on a horse. It came natural to go to a motorcycle. I got a small one, and then I got a larger one. Then I got a factory-made special, and I raced on dirt tracks in eastern Kansas, down as far as Oklahoma, or down in Missouri. But I was never real famous as it, but I always qualified.
So you're racing motorcycles on dirt tracks. How safe of an endeavor was that, George?
It was considered so unsafe that when I got in the military, I wanted to be an aviation cadet, and the first thing I had to do was dispose of my motorcycle.
And when we hear about the plane you flew your missions in and its reputation, boy, that's going to put that in perspective, too. I've got to ask you, since you know you are in that part of the country during the Great Depression, and we've heard so many stories about that, was that something that you felt out on the farm? Did you see the effects of this downturn in the country?
Everywhere. The temperature in the summertime was over 100 every day. It was not only hot, but it was dry. And then on top of that, we had grasshoppers. And some of the grasshoppers were 3 inches long. They were the locusts. They can't fly. They're so big and fat. So all they do is eat and just keep walking. And they destroy everything in sight.
Does that include your guys' farm?
Well, they weren't that severe that they destroyed it, but you can find them everywhere.
You mentioned aviation. Was that a bug that you caught early? I mean, do you remember when you first got turned on to this idea of getting up in an airplane and flying around?
I was 10 years old in 1927, and I distinctly remember Lindbergh's exploits. I whittled out wooden propellers and would hit them on a little model airplane. My dad would drive the car. I'd stick the little airplane out in the airflow, and it would roar like a... So my mother just couldn't stand that thing.
So you had a little glimpse of your future right there. What was it, though, that made you decide in 1941 to join the Army Air Corps? Where did that come from? What was your motivation?
I think the prime motivation was a little card I got that said, "Greetings from your friends and fellow countrymen. You have been selected and have the distinct privilege of serving 1 year in the U.S. military, and you will be provided with another dot, 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 dot. Have you ever seen one of those cards?
A little draft notice from Uncle Sam?
Yeah, that's what it was. And I rode a troop train from Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, to Central California in 1941.
Where'd you end up in California?
Camp Roberts. And that is up as far as you can get from nowhere. Halfway between San Francisco and Los Angeles.
I know that we have some regular listeners there at Camp Roberts who hear this program, so they're out there in Paso Robles right now saying, yeah, it hasn't changed all that much. So you're drafted into the regular Army. I mean, this is not the Army Air Corps yet.
No, that was the regular Army.
What was your welcome to the Army moment there at Camp Roberts?
It had rained for at least a week. We got off of this old troop train. Union Pacific had put it together out of some salvage yard somewhere in Texas or Oklahoma and dragged us out there. We got off the train and the mud was more than ankle deep. They had just finished building most of the barracks, not all, and none of the roads or sidewalks or anything. They had little wooden platforms from one barracks to the next, out to the mess hall. There was no parade field or anything at Camp Roberts at the time I got there.
And how'd they treat you? I mean, you're a tough farm kid who's been milking cows and stacking hay and dealing with all that. Did they still have some toughening up to do of you? Or how challenging were those training days?
It was no challenge to me. I was very familiar with a military rifle. They gave us one of those. I got along fine.
I'm just going to take a wild guess here. Is that where you were on December 7th, 1941?
By that time, I was down Camp San Luis Obispo, and I was riding a motorcycle, escorting convoys and military vehicles about the base and up and down Highway 101.
There's some fun little curves on that road to be on a motorcycle for, right?
Oh, I could drag the footboards on most of them.
I believe it, knowing your background. Well, tell me about that date of infamy, December 7th, 1941. You're already in uniform, so I imagine that added to your perspective that day. But how'd you find out? What happened?
Had worked town patrol the night before in San Luis Obispo and didn't get in until 1 or 2 o'clock, so I was entitled to sleep in. However, somebody came in and threw a bandolier of ammunition right on me on the bed and said, "Get up, we're in war." I got a bite to eat. I escorted some officer that had driven into the base, and I escorted him down to where that Japanese submarine shelled.
This is by Santa Barbara, Point Magoo, right around there?
That's right.
You know, a lot of people don't realize that a Japanese submarine surfaced and shelled in that Santa Barbara area, but that was my question for you. As you get this news, and I don't want to lose track of your story here, escorting the guy down there, but was there a concern among the guys you were with that, hey, the Japanese are coming here to California?
It was a concern. We carried loaded guns, which were not very effective, but we did. I escorted this major down, and he dug that round, the projectile, that didn't explode. He dug it out and put it in the back of his government little Plymouth sedan and took it off to somewhere else.
So you are actually there while he's doing this? He grabs a round from a Japanese submarine that landed on U.S. soil on the West Coast. You saw him carry it off?
Definitely. He just put it in the back of that Plymouth station wagon, let it roll around in there. He wasn't excited about it going off.
That had to be kind of surreal for you. It's not just at Pearl Harbor. This is California, and you're seeing that a Japanese shell landed right there.
Oh, I was there.
Was that eye-opening for you to witness that?
Oh, yes. But everything was new. California was new. All those things were new at that time.
Well, I mean, just imagining if I were there, and, you know, we have the hindsight. We have the 2020 hindsight. Now we know what happened. But in that moment, if you know a Japanese sub was there, there's shells that have been fired, you probably think there's more coming, right?
I'm not sure what I thought. You can see that it was daylight. They had fired the shells in when it was dark. I'm not aware of anybody that panicked about the fact that they had done it. They did it, so what?
What about when you heard about the devastation on Oahu? and 2,400 Americans have been killed in these surprise attacks by Japan. What kind of emotions or reaction did that stir in you?
I think everybody slipped the safety off of the 45. But other than that, all we had to do was, you're in the military, let's line up, get aboard.
Well, and I'm just hearing your story about racing motorcycles on dirt tracks in eastern Kansas. I'm thinking, hey, if you stayed in the Army, maybe you could have been pulling those Steve McQueen tricks in The Great Escape or something like that. Although you're more likely to end up in one of those POW camps as an airman, which you became. What was the point where you said, no, I want to get into the Army Air Corps and I want to be up in one of those planes?
When I was first drafted into the military, I wanted to get into Army Air Corps every chance I got, but they didn't open up the opportunities until after Pearl Harbor. Then I stood in line. There were five of us. Four of the people that rode motorcycles become either pilots or navigators. So in mass, we went from motorcycles to aircraft.
So they had to find a bunch more guys for motorcycles, I guess. But was your ambition, was your thinking in joining the Army Air Corps that you would become a pilot? Was that your goal?
Oh, yes.
How'd that work out for you?
Well, I was at King City, California. I was the first cadet back one morning. I had only about 17 hours of flying time. And as I turned final, we had no radios now. You just got the green light. I got the green light. And at the same time, an airplane was taking off. But I didn't see him. Remember now at King City, we had a big open area that we landed on or took off from, and we had a runway. Well, this other aircraft was a single-engine BT-13 trainer, a Vultee vibrator. When the tower gave the green light, I thought I was cleared to land, and he thought he was cleared to take off, so he gave me a lot of prop washing. The result was I dragged a wingtip, and if you made any mistakes at all, you became a navigator or a bombardier, because they had so many pilot applications and so few for a navigator or a bombardier. So that's how I become a bombardier.
And what were you in, a steerman or what?
That was an old Ryan PT-22.
They have a distinct sound, too, when you hear one of those Ryans in the air.
Oh, yes.
Well, that had to be disappointing for you, because here it seems like something outside of your control that caused that snafu for you, and now you don't get to be a pilot anymore. How did you feel about that?
First of all, that's wartime. I couldn't do anything about it. So you could cry, or you could get down. And I had a chance at navigator or bombardier because I had qualified. When we first became cadets, we were given a classification, qualified for pilot, navigator, bombardier. You got a 1 to 9, and I got 9 on all three. So I said, bombardier's the quickest. It only takes about 14 weeks or something like that. So I became a bombardier. And then I became a bombardier instructor.
All before you went overseas? You were instructing before you went over?
At Albuquerque.
Kirtland Air Force Base now, huh?
That's right.
We have folks listening today in Albuquerque, too, and I know that was a big spot for bomber instructors. Was there anything about being a bombardier that you felt was particularly challenging or maybe distinctive or important to understand about that role?
Not necessarily. I could have been a navigator, too. I later went through navigation school after the war, but that's the quickest one to finish training and get out of here.
So what kind of bombers were you instructing in?
When I was an instructor, we just used twin beach turners. I think each cadet got to drop about 90 bombs, and they were all scored on how close they could bomb to the target because they were all photographed.
So is that something where you'd go up with them on those training missions and critique what they were doing?
Oh, yes.
The bombs they're dropping, were they sacks of flour or what were they?
They were blue whistlers, 100-pound bomb. If you go over here to the museum, there are a couple of them sitting alongside the wall.
You're talking about the Warhawk Air Museum right here in Nampa, one of the finest air museums around, where you celebrated your 100th birthday not too long ago. So your time in Albuquerque there, correct me if I'm wrong. Again, I'm just flying blind here, but I'm guessing you probably could have stayed in that role as an instructor for as long as you wanted to.
I could have stayed longer, but a friend of mine was having trouble. His main trouble was probably the bottle, but he convinced me that we should go to B-26s down in Florida, MacDill Field, because his home was in Florida.
Had you heard anything about the B-26s?
It hadn't been good. There's been a Truman Commission that condemned them. And then a Jimmy Doolittle story got out, and the panic was over. That might be a good story for you to chase down sometime. The Truman Commission made all that fuss about the Martin B-26.
Yeah, they called it the Martin murderer or the flying prostitute, a plane a day in Tampa Bay.
Oh, yeah.
This Truman Commission says this plane's not safe to fly. We're losing too many American servicemen before they even get overseas, just in training.
That's right. But Doolittle had been a World War I. He'd been trained for it, but didn't fly. He was an acrobatic pilot and a stunt pilot and everything, and a test pilot and all that. He volunteered to fly one for the Truman Commission to see how it flew. And he feathered one. It had a reputation that you couldn't turn into the dead engine. But he took one up and did everything with it. Turned into the dead engine, rolled it, did all kind of acrobatics with this airplane. And then he testified before Truman that it was altogether the way you have been training the people. You've got to train them to fly this airplane because it is a good airplane if it's flown right. And he showed them. And the morale above cadets and young officers just went way up.
And some people listening might not really be familiar with the B-26 because so much attention is paid to the bigger bombers, the B-17, the B-24, later the B-29. For someone who has never seen a B-26, describe that aircraft for us.
It's a twin-engine, mid-wing, round fuselage, a single vertical tail.
And how about the crew?
The full crew was 7 men. But it carried, for power, the Pratt & Whitney R2800 engine and a Curtiss-Wright propellers. The engines had so much power, the original Curtiss Electric propellers only carried a 12-volt system. As you would accelerate on takeoff, the propeller has to change pitch as the forward travel of the airplane permits the propeller to overspeed unless it changes pitch. And the original Curtiss-Wright had a 12-volt system. And 12 volts wasn't enough power to keep up with the takeoff power of the Pratt & Whitney engine. As a result, the engine could overspeed the propeller, and of course that overspeeds the engine, and you lose forward power if your propeller isn't pulling you forward, and it's just churning around out there, so the aircraft loses power on that engine. You can't control an aircraft on single engine at 60 or 70 miles an hour with a rudder. It won't do it. So they were losing the airplanes due to the 12-volt systems were overpowered. When they put a 24-volt system on, problem solved.
At a cost of a lot of American lives, and that's right. What a lot of people don't understand about this time is how many people died domestically before they ever got overseas because no one had ever done this before. You guys were learning on the fly. I've got to ask you, once you made that move down there to MacDill and were training with the B-26s, did you have to deal with the loss of guys you knew?
Yes, our squadron commander was killed. Within a week of the time I arrived down there, we lost a couple airplanes while I was there.
I can't imagine that's very encouraging. If you're thinking about flying this plane into combat and with people shooting at you and all those hazards, I mean, if you can't even, you know, keep it safe in Tampa Bay, how are you going to survive overseas?
They changed to 24-volt systems soon after I got there. I flew a few missions out of Tampa, and I was only there about 5 weeks or something like that until I went over to Lakeland. At Lakeland, we had a completely different attitude of everybody. Doolittle's people had trained at Lakeland. A year before I got there, there were still some of the people around, and they were crazy about the airplanes. Our maintenance people were much more experienced. The confidence was there. The biggest problem we had was alligators in downtown Lakeland.
Is there a personal encounter you had there you want to tell me about?
No, but it was common knowledge that afternoon the police officers would carry a cane. And what do you think they carried a cane for?
To whack the alligator snouts or what?
They'd just threaten the alligator. And they had one they called Old Bull. And he'd come out right on the main drag and sun himself. The cop would have to come along, and if he had that cane, why, the alligator'd leave. He'd go back in the water.
Something tells me that is not the hazard you expected to hear about from a man who flew 46 missions as a B-26 bombardier in Europe. We'll hear about some of those missions when we come back with 100-year-old George Eldridge of Nampa, Idaho, right after this.